Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm of course your host, Cara Santa Maria, and I've been away from you guys for a couple of weeks. I've missed you so very much. I hope you all had a great non-religious, non-denominational Christmas Hanukkah. You know, a Festivus for the rest of us, as some like to say. Mine was very fun. I also got a really great gift. I got a very cool meteorite for Christmas, and I've been showing it off to all my friends. I haven't yet taken a photo of it and put it online. Not sure why. Also, I joined Instagram. All of my friends said that would never happen, and it did. I'm not very good at it yet, but maybe you can come say hi. I honestly don't even know what my Instagram name is. I think, ironically, I don't know why it's ironic, but Cara Santa Maria was taken. I didn't know there were any others. I think it's something like Cara underscore Santa underscore Maria. I don't know. Whatever seemed reasonable to go to next. So hit me up and say hi. I don't even know if that's what you do on Instagram, but look at pictures of my puppy, Killer. Oh, so since it's been so long, it's been two whole weeks, I have a lot of people to thank. You guys are just so amazing. As you know, the podcast is something that I do on my own. I record, I seek out my guests, I edit it, I post it up. And you guys go to my website, carasantamaria.com, and you support the podcast. And it's so cool. Those of you who have clicked on that little button that that took you to PayPal so that you could give me a little tip. And it's just huge. And I can't thank you enough. So I want to give some shout outs to all of you who did it in my absence. First, I want to thank those of you who have set up to make regular payments, whether it's weekly, monthly, or even just yearly. I want to thank Michael S. Bigelow. I want to thank Michael Nelson. I want to thank Mark Bahaj, I think, or maybe Bajaj. Could be. I want to thank Nicholas Recker. I also want to thank Michael Quinn and Jake Krog. And lastly, I want to thank James Talent. It's really amazing of you guys to continue to contribute, to keep Talk Nerdy 100% free to download for everybody who enjoys it. I also want to thank those of you who went on and donated to keep the podcast alive over the course of this absence. I want to thank Bianca Fopp from Playa del Rey here in California. I want to thank Julius Moigrasi from LA here in California. Wow, guys, we're neighbors. I want to thank Jeffrey Tony from Scotch Plains, New Jersey. I also want to thank Greg Rogers. Ooh, I already thanked you, Greg. Sorry. You're so nice, I'll thank you twice. I want to thank Kristen Lynn from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Zach Zimmerman from Klamath Falls, Oregon. So many falls out there. And once again, I want to thank Julius Moigrasi. I'm thanking you twice too, but that's because you hooked it up twice. Thanks, Julius, my LA neighbor. I used to live on 3rd Street, actually. Interesting. Nobody stalked Julius. Okay, there's no sponsors of this week's episode, so you'll get to listen to it straight through. I do want to let you guys know that it is a new year, and I am looking for sponsors. I have some lined up already, but those of you who own small businesses who are looking for a place to advertise, this is a really great opportunity. If you go to shoptalknerdy@gmail.com, shoot me an email. I can send you my rate sheet, and we can help each other and help keep each other afloat and help support each other. It's worked out in the past that I've been able to hook up with some really cool people with some really cool businesses and get their message out to everybody who might be interested. So yeah, if that is something that makes sense to you, shoot me an email. Again, shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. And don't forget to go to iTunes or Stitcher to download, to rate, to review, to say all the good things, if you have the good things to say. And also, you know, visit the site. Check out some cool swag I got there. Okay. I'm sure you're bored of me shamelessly self-promoting. So I think we're going to jump right in. I'm very, very pleased to announce that this week's guest is actually somebody I recorded with quite a few weeks ago when I was at the Skepticon conference. He is a biology professor at the University of Minnesota Morris. He specializes in developmental and neurobiology. and you probably know him best from his blog, Pharyngula or Pharyngula. I ask him on the air. He says that he doesn't really know the right way to say it, so that makes me feel better. His name's Dr. P.Z. Myers, and his blog, he said in 2002, is one, he found it in 2002, and he said that it is one, in his own words, that discusses, quote, evolution, development, and random biological ejaculations from a godless liberal. Sounds about right. All right, guys, so with no further ado, my guest this week, Dr. P.Z. Myers. Well, Dr. Myers, thank you so much for joining me. Do you like Dr. Myers, or is PZ more comfortable
PZ's
for you?
PZ's nicer.
PZ's nicer. Nicer on the ears. I like PZ because you know what? Nobody else goes by those initials. I've never met another PZ.
It makes me special.
It's very special.
The only bad thing is that sometimes there's a lot of people who call me PJ.
That's weird.
Pajamas, I guess.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people named PJ.
Yeah.
Which is also odd a little bit.
Right.
But PZ is cool. And it's I don't know, it's firm. Having a Z in your name is a very cool thing.
Right. Z's are weird.
So Z's are weird. And then, of course, if you're not in the States, then you're PZ, which is even weirder.
Yeah.
Well, so we are here at Skepticon, which you have been a part of since its inception, right? This is year 7, but I was reading on the program. This is the first time I've been invited. I'm just now learning to make the rounds of the skeptic community. But I read on the program that you've done this this conference every year.
Every year. It's weird. It's really strange. But so I got invited to the first one by J.T. Eberhard, who was the initial organizer. And that was a very small meeting. It was just me and Richard Carrier. And it was just on the university campus nearby.
Oh, wow. And so it was more of a campus gathering of secular kids?
It wasn't so much a conference as just a meeting with two people, which was nice. And then it just snowballed from there really fast. I mean, if you look at the Skepticon website, you can see they get more and more speakers every year, and it quickly hit, 15, 20, somewhere in that.
Yeah,
I am.
And so many attendees too.
Yes,
and it's great that it's a free conference, so it's open to anybody who can get their asses here and put them in a seat.
Yes,
which is exciting.
It's great for us. I know the organizers sweat blood all year long.
Sure. I'm absolutely sure. Yeah, that must be very, very tough. Yeah.
But they seem very committed to it. That's good.
And you make the journey out because you live in Minnesota. You don't live in Missouri. And you're a professor there. What got you? I guess I want to talk about both of those aspects, because my podcast generally is a science-focused podcast, but I love to discuss skepticism. I love to talk about atheism, especially when I have a great opportunity like this to be at a conference with kind of like-minded people. So maybe we start with biology, and then we get a little bit
into
skepticism.
That sounds lovely, yes.
When did you first find biology?
Oh, man, that is way, way back in Paleozoic, I think. No, I made a commitment to science when I was a wee little kid.
Really?
Yeah. My earliest memory is my mother teaching me how to use a little toy plastic microscope.
Aw.
And I don't know, it stuck with me. Now I'm a microscopist for a living, but and my grandmother had a set of she had these pictures she saved from when I was like 5 years old, and I was all, you know, the typical thing, drawing dinosaurs and animals, but my unique touch was that I would draw this little squiggle at their head. It was their brains. It was very important to note that these animals had brains, and so I would draw them, and then I ended up going into neuroscience. So I was fixed early.
That's wonderful. And now you're a professor still. It's been many years, but you're still a professor. And you also have a very public blog, which I absolutely adore, because I think it's so wonderful when I see individuals who have kind of gone through traditional academic settings breaking the mold that academia really tries to restrict you to, which is publish or perish, don't do any public communication, stay in the ivory tower, and keep yourself a bit separate from the public.
Right. Well, you know, this whole science communication gig that you're into is, as you mentioned in your talk yesterday, lots of people were there before you.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of us thought that was really important. You know, in my case, I went through the traditional trajectory of you go to graduate school, you do a couple postdocs, you go off and get a real job. You know, I get a professorship somewhere. And what happened is my first professorship was at Temple University. Mm-hmm. And I was doing this stuff. And this was the first time they told me, you have to teach.
You had never taught all through graduate school?
In my first year of graduate school, I was a teaching assistant in a lab. And then I immediately got research grants.
Oh,
and so,
funny.
So then they tell you, now you're a teacher. And you've got no training at all.
Yeah, they never teach you how to do
that's
it.
That's right. But what I found is that that's what I really liked. Mm. So I got more into that than in the research. And then at the same time, you know, I as somebody who was studying evolutionary biology and developmental biology and all these things, I was beginning to become painfully aware that the public was hopelessly ignorant on these subjects.
Sure.
And so I started doing more public outreach and getting into that and turned into a militant evolutionist.
Which is the only type of evolutionist
that's right.
You could really be. So if you were to take a pie chart of your time now, what percentage of it would you say is dedicated towards research, towards teaching, and towards outreach?
Oh, let me think. Actually, I would say the biggest part of the pie chart would be teaching.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm at a small university. We have a standard 3-2 teaching load, you know, three courses one semester, two the next semester.
Okay.
So that's a pretty full schedule. Mm-hmm. I've got three labs to teach, and I've got three classes. And so that eats up most of my time. I probably spend, maybe 2 hours or so on the blog and that kind of thing. And I do public speaking. Every couple of weeks, I fly off somewhere.
Every couple of weeks? That's
yeah.
That's quite
yeah.
a bit. That's a
yeah.
That's dedication.
And that means that research probably comes in third place. Most of my research time is in the summer.
Okay.
Because it's an undergraduate-only institution. So that means during the school year, the people who should be working with me have got other priorities. So usually in the summer, I take on a couple of students. And that's when we sit down and spend all of our time doing research.
That's a pretty cool model, too, because that allows you to really have kind of narrow focus at any given time. Academics now, research then, instead of which I think a lot of graduate students, especially in the master's level, because the master's level is very much a hybrid between undergrad and PhD. You're still totally taking a full load of coursework, but you're trying to figure out how to do a research project in minimal time. And it can be very trying for some people.
Right. And also I should mention, you know, that when I'm doing summer research, to me that's often much more about the teaching than the research, because here I've got a couple of naive young students.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know anything. I will spend a week or two teaching them to use a pipette and a pair of forceps, you know, that kind of thing. And it's only near the end of the summer that they start getting results.
And how wonderful to get that kinds of really hands-on training at the undergraduate level, so that by the time, because I definitely know when I was working on my master's degree, we had some undergrads who were working in the lab, and we had some, you know, PhD students and some postdocs, and I managed the cell culture facility after about a year of work in it. I ended up managing it and kind of overseeing a lot of hands going in and out of my incubators and being neurotic about that. And I realized that there were kids who had finished their undergraduate degree who didn't have basic understandings of lab etiquette or just of technical skills in the lab. They couldn't, you know, calibrate a pH meter or something like that. It's like, how do you get through an entire undergraduate biology degree without doing that?
Yeah. I mean, you can do that just about any university. I mean, even at my university, you can skip the whole lab research experience. Just do the, you know, the canned labs that you do in your classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very unfortunate. We've been making a big push with our students to get them to either work in one of the labs or apply for REUs and things like that and get at least a semester of experience doing science. Because that, you know, science isn't sitting down and reading a book and thinking about it. It's doing it.
Totally. Why study science if you're not going to do it? It doesn't make much sense. You know, I was fortunate in my undergrad that I had two tracks I could take. I was a psychology major, actually, in undergrad. But I could do a BA or a BS. And the BS required maybe like three extra stats and research methods courses and a thesis, an honors thesis as an undergrad. And so I got to learn at least, you know, it wasn't wet lab work, but at least statistical methods to ask a scientific question and to dig into the research and to try and answer it, which was very good training. I don't think I would have been prepared to then switch and get a master's in like hard biology if I hadn't had that kind of scientific side of psychology, which a lot of people go without.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of what I think of it as, is, you know, at the undergraduate level, you're not going to make earth-shaking discoveries. Mm-hmm. You're not going to revolutionize anything. Well, maybe if you're a genius, you will. Some of my students have been pretty bright. but what I feel like is, okay, I'm going to give you some basic experience in the lab. You'll know how to use a pipette, right? That kind of thing. And you'll be ready when you go off to graduate school. You won't be a total dork when you step in the lab and don't know what to do.
And you won't be spending half of your first semester learning that stuff. You'll be able to jump right in and understand, oh, what are the methods that we use in this lab that are specific to this lab?
Right.
Which, you know, there are global methods like pipetting that probably we should all know. So what made you first want to start your blog? Because you've been blogging since, like, the beginning of blogging. You've been blogging since it was kind of not even a cool thing to blog.
Right. Actually, it was desperation. So I mentioned I was at Temple, and then I moved from Temple to the University of Minnesota Morris. They put out this ad, and I read the ad, and it was exactly what I wanted to do. You know, small liberal arts college, teaching emphasis. They needed a developmental biologist, and I was very lucky to get the job. The drawback to Morris is it's out in rural West Minnesota. It's 3 hours from any city.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like this little monastic cloister for the students in the middle of nowhere.
And where did you grow up? Were you a city kid?
I grew up near Seattle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and we'd actually moved there from Temple University, which is in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a shift. And it's a small university. So there was a grand total of 7 biology faculty at that time. We're now up to 8. And, you know, biology is this huge discipline. Everyone is different.
Completely.
It's nice to talk to an ecologist. You learn something new. But there was no other developmental biologist there. And there was nobody who had the same interest in evolution that I did. So.
And so you're dealing with not being challenged except by your students.
Yeah. And, you know, at the bigger universities, you get used to that thing of, you know, at least once a week, you're going out with your buddies and you're drinking beer and you're sitting there talking science.
Mm-hmm.
So the blog was my substitute.
That's wonderful. And it's grown into something so much more than a conversation about evolutionary biology. It's got this huge following of people in this kind of skeptic community. Right. So was that just something that kind of developed organically out of writing about evolution?
Yes, because a lot of the focus, you know, when you're writing for the lay public, how do you get them engaged?
Mm-hmm.
I could talk about abstract aspects of evolutionary biology, and there are some blogs out there that do that really well, but that's going to limit the number of people that want to talk to you. It's, you know, it's narrow, it's abstract, it's very complicated. So my pathway was to talk about creationism. Here's this big problem. These people are believing this. Like, even today, you know, when I give my talk tonight, it's about molecular genetics, but it's about creationist misunderstandings of the subject and how they get everything wrong, but they're so good at putting up this facade of being knowledgeable.
It's so odd how there's a whole movement now within that kind of ID community of trying to use the science for their side, which is just a huge bastardization of science. But if you stand up with a strong enough authoritative stance and you use words that sound like complicated scientific words, people will look at you and say, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. This is important to listen to.
Yeah. So like this talk tonight, what got it started is people kept writing to me and they said, here's this paper in this creationist journal, and it's all molecular biology and it's really impressive stuff. Do they actually know what they're doing? And, you know, I looked at it in an instant. I could see this is crap. Mm. But most people won't be able to.
Yeah, how do you do that without a trained eye? I don't even know I could because, you know, molecular was not my background. That's not what I felt. I was a systems neuroscientist. You know, I was looking at network neuroscience and I had a bit of molecular training, but it just wasn't the focus of my research. And after a while, when something becomes so specialized, you don't have that expertise.
Yes. And that's kind of a problem in science right now is we're all specialists.
Yep.
We all have our little narrow domain and we know it really well. And people are good at exploiting gaps in our knowledge. You know, I've noticed this really interesting phenomenon when I'm arguing with creationists. They'll start peppering me with questions about biology, and then it comes out that I'm a professional biologist, and immediately they stop, and they start, no, we're going to talk about geology now.
Yeah. That's something that you see a lot, too, with the kind of climate change denialism is quoting scientists who are physicists or scientists who are, you know, biologists. It's like, these aren't the experts. We want to talk to the climatologists. What do they have to say?
Yeah.
My opinion about climate change is, I mean, as a journalist might be more relevant, but if I were still doing neuroscience daily, it would be much less relevant.
Right. And much worse, they'll go to TV weathermen.
That's so true. Or they'll go to individuals who are, you know, overtly funded and bankrolled by fossil fuel companies, which is a huge danger.
Yeah.
Well, I think I think it's really interesting to see how your blog has grown. And for those, by the way, because I've only ever read it and I've never talked about it publicly, Pharyngula or Pharyngula?
Either way goes. I mean,
does it? Okay, good to know. Yeah. I've always said pharyngula, but then I've heard people say pharyngula.
Yeah, I usually say pharyngula.
Oh, but, okay.
Yeah, it's a fairly recent word. It was coined in the 60s, I think it was, by Bill Ballard, who is a fish embryologist.
What does it mean? What does it refer to?
You know, the pharynx, right? So it refers to the stage in embryonic development when the organism is first building these cartilages that form the branchial basket beneath the jaws.
I love it. And did you just love the way it rolls off the tongue?
It sounds nice. It's also I also think it's the most interesting time in development because that's also the time when the Hox genes switch on. Mm. It's when large body patterns are first set up. You know, when you look at it, I work with zebrafish. And when you look at a zebrafish embryo at that age, it's just this kind of comma-shaped blob. But that's when it starts to build organs, just at that particular stage.
And when you start to be able to see the segments, that you start to know that there will be a tail there and there will be little flippers here.
Yes.
Are they called flippers in a fish?
No, they're called fins.
Yeah, I obviously have never worked with zebrafish. I have worked with the zebra finch. Which is another
is a
model organism,
animal.
But a totally different animal. It is a little bird, but a common model animal in neuroscience research, actually, because songbirds obviously make new neurons throughout the lifespan. And I did a little bit of research looking at adult neurogenesis in the zebra finch. Most of my research was mammalian, though. Most of my undergrad and my master's, I was focusing on mice. And so it was, for me, a huge shift starting the PhD, which I ultimately did not finish, but working with these little birds with these weird brains and they didn't have a cortex and they'd fly away from you. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, you know, I actually started as an undergraduate doing mostly mammalian work myself. I sort of worked my way through college by getting, you know, work-study positions in research labs and doing that sort of thing. And most of what I was doing at first was analyzing mouse brains. We were slicing them up and I was counting cells and measuring cell sizes and things like that. And, you know, I found it unsatisfactory because...
Interesting.
They're too complicated.
They're very complicated.
Yeah. I wanted something simpler. And so I fell into a lab that was doing Drosophila work, looking at Drosophila neurogenesis and looking at early developmental events there.
And in Drosophila, I know that with C. elegans, which is like a basic worm, we know exactly how many cells it has
in
its body.
It's 958 neurons.
There you go. We know exactly how many neurons. We know we've mapped its genome. Like, it's a very, it's the puzzle pieces are laid out for us, and now we can really learn a lot more about the individual puzzle pieces. Is now, is Drosophila that way too, or is it still more complex than that?
No, it's more complex than that. Yeah, and that's kind of what happened is I said, okay, I'm going to work on something simpler. I'll go work on flies with this guy. And what we then did is adult flies are too complicated.
Yeah.
They got way too much going on in them. So what we end up doing is you end up going earlier and earlier in embryogenesis, trying to reach that point where there's a manageable number of neurons that you can comprehend. And I went through that same path once I started working with zebrafish, as we initially started working with 5-day-old zebrafish, which have 200,000 neurons.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Way too common. Especially when you're trying to really map something out. You know, I was working with E15 mice. So they were embryonic, day 15, not born yet. But our goal was to take these neurons and kind of enzymatically divide them so that they would turn into little basketballs. They would lose all their neuronal connections, but they were young enough that I could plate them and they would regrow into a flat neural network so I could see it through a microscope and so I could collect electrical data. We did mostly electrophysiology in my lab. So that worked well for me, but I did not have to know how many neurons there were, what each neuron did. I just wanted kind of blanket, young, I can be in anything neurons that I could put onto a plate and have them grow and have synchrony. And that allowed me to, but even those fetal mouse brains were a bit easier to manage than adult mouse brains. One thing that I realized, and I think that you are somebody I'm excited to talk to about this because not many people are as outspoken as you are in the sciences and as kind of unafraid, of course, as having certain conversations. I speak to scientists all the time in their labs for television programs who do animal research. And of course, we can't talk about lots of things publicly because there's a reason to be afraid. You don't want to get your lab bombed. You don't want your animals released. A zebrafish lab might not get as much hate as a mammalian lab, but who knows? There are people out there.
Actually, we have a slightly different problem.
Huh.
So when I was at the University of Oregon, for instance, we had a zebrafish facility, and we zebrafish pump out eggs like mad.
Okay.
Okay, every tank, you'll get a couple hundred eggs every day.
Oh, wow.
And most of them end up dead and disposed of, right? So it meant we, in all our little forms, we had to explain that we are generating 100,000 embryos a year, right? And they're all dying. At the same time, there was one lab on campus that was working with monkeys. Mm-hmm. They would do one monkey a year. So guess what the animal rights organizations would do?
Oh, how funny.
Here's a picture of a monkey. University of Oregon kills 100,000 animals a year.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, that's horrible. That's absolutely. See, these are people that need a stats lesson for sure. That's just terrible.
Right. And I actually had a lot of respect for the guy who was doing the monkey research. You know,
of course.
He was doing interesting things. And he was doing it on a very limited budget. And he was respectful of the animals. And he was using as few animals as he could.
And probably with so much pushback from the public, which is really tough. There are some great organizations out there, like Speaking of Research, who really promote animal research in a way that I think is an educational effort for the public. You know, I've worked in animal research. You obviously continue to. Most scientists, most biologists, I should say, at some point in their career and probably throughout their career are going to be working with animals.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an important conversation to be had about, I think, animal rights versus animal welfare. I have a very strong feeling that animal rights is not a thing. Animals don't vote. Animals don't have a constitution. But animal welfare is a very important aspect of this work. We are cloning these animals or breeding these animals or are building up populations of these animals in order to work with them. We should respect them. We should respect their pain sensibilities. We should, you know, as you said, use as minimal animals as we can. And one thing I struggled with when I was doing mouse research, even though I could use one pregnant mouse a week and take all of the embryos and plate hundreds of experiments based on that, which at the time, compared to other labs, was a really wonderful use of resources. Mm-hmm. I did sometimes look at the experiments that were being done, and I wondered if they were worth it. And that was a hard thing for me. I appreciated the science that was being done in my lab, but there were certain groups that were doing things that, I mean, who am I? But I wasn't sure why. A lot of times it felt like the experiments that were being done to show that the platform we used in the lab was an appropriate platform, and they were less about asking legitimate research questions. And after a while of sacrificing mice, I sacrificed one mouse every day throughout my master's and for a year afterwards. After a while, I didn't want to do it anymore.
Right.
I didn't want to take the life of this mouse. And I knew why I didn't it, and it was important for me to do it, but eventually I was over it.
Yeah. I felt the same way.
Really?
Yeah. As I mentioned, I did a lot of mammalian work my early years as an undergraduate. And one of my jobs is I was the caretaker for an animal surgery.
Oh, wow.
So that was everything. Lots of cats and rabbits, a fair number of dogs, goats, monkeys, everything would come there for surgeries. And thing is, this wasn't a research establishment. This was a surgical training office.
I see. So these animals didn't necessarily even need the surgeries.
Oh, most of them didn't need it. No, this was let's bring in the new doctors and have them practice on a rabbit before we turn them loose on people.
Sure. Which is important. I mean, let's be honest, it's incredibly important.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I had to do a lot of the surgeries myself, and you quickly acquire a great appreciation for the skill because, yeah, you might say, well, let's just do it with simulations and all that. But then when you work with the real animals, you learn, oh, well, if I cut here and I get this bleeder, how do I quickly take care of it
completely?
Right.
And surgery's hard. I mean, I didn't learn to do surgery until I started the PhD with the little zebra finch birds, because one of the things that we would do is we would damage their ears so that they wouldn't be able to hear the song, and then we would see how their brains change because of that. But you have to do it and then bring them back to life so they can continue to give you data. Up until that point, all the mammalian work I did was not surgery. It was sacrifice and dissection. It's much easier to work with tissue when it's fresh after you've just sacrificed the animal. I didn't have to bring them back to life. That's a whole other set of problems.
And there's the pain management,
exactly.
Anesthesia. Oh,
you don't want them to be in pain. You want them to be healthy and happy and just like they were before the surgery. That's the goal, right?
That's right.
It's the goal with people, and it's the goal with trying to get good data.
Mm-hmm. And that was a big push in this lab, is every surgery had to be professionally done, that the animals had to be well taken care of, there had to be somebody there when they came back to consciousness. There was a lot of ethical concern about what they're doing. But at the same time, they're doing, you know, we were doing like 5-10 surgeries a day on large animals.
Wow.
And it was all for the purposes of training doctors.
And then where do those animals go? You know, these are legitimate questions.
Yes.
What happens to them? It's one thing when you, again, you're using a lab animal, you sacrifice it, you dispose of it. It did its duty. You respected that. And now it's gone. It doesn't have to live out its life in maybe a situation that it wouldn't choose to do.
And a lot of these animals were, we did double duty with them. They would be used for training young doctors, but what they would do, for instance, is chronic implants for neuroscience research. So the animals would then go off and be used in experimental studies. And then, they'd bring them back and tell me, okay, time to kill this one.
Yeah, and that's tough too. You know, it's like developing an attachment or preventing yourself from developing attachment to a lab animal, I find that it's harder the more, you know, as you get into mammals, as you get into larger, the more that they have a cute face, I think, the more that they represent something that you may have in your home as a pet or a family member, the more that we're just kind of socially programmed in many ways to, you know, feel uncomfortable with that. So mice are very cute, you know, they're little. And when they bite you, you don't like them anymore. No. But until then, they're very cute.
You can't blame them either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Dogs, cats, rabbits, that becomes much more difficult.
Right. And the dilemma was compounded because one of my other duties was we were trying to maintain the psychological well-being of the animals. So I'd have to go in for an hour every day and play with the cats.
Oh, geez. And then when it's time to sacrifice a cat, yeah. It's, you know, and do they have names? I remember working in the bird lab with this amazing professor, Dr. Pitta, and she, my first kind of really strong, well, that's not true, but in graduate school, my first strong female mentor, and I remember asking her, oh, do they have names? And she was like, do not name the birds. Like, no, they have numbers. And it's like, because you don't want to, they are kind of cute. But you don't want to get attached to them because it makes it harder for you to be objective in your research.
We did give them names, but they were kind of descriptive names, you know, big red tiger, things like that. You go by how they look. But yeah, you get to know them.
Definitely. And that can be difficult. You know, I did a piece quite a while ago for the Huffington Post about animal research. And it was a real struggle for me. I'll tell a quick story and then I won't hog up too much time. But it was a real struggle for me because I was new at HuffPost and I had been doing science stories. And I had an editor and he is a very capable and very good editor. But we did sometimes butt heads about certain things. And at the time, his boss was not in the science field, was much more of a journalist who also was, I think, just interested in getting traffic to the page. And so they sent me an article that was in New Scientist, and it was Chinese researchers who had a monkey, not an ape, but a monkey that was attached to, you know, some sort of interface where he could use his mind. This was early on to control a robotic arm. Uh-huh. And this robotic arm actually had articulated fingers. And so they were like, we want you to write about this. Oh, shit, this is so cool. Articulated fingers. This is a huge leap. This is going to be major for war veterans and all this stuff. So I got really excited and I started to write about it. And then I filed and they said, this is an advocacy piece. This is a science advocacy piece and an animal research advocacy piece. And we're not going to publish this. And I was like, what did you want me to do? I think science journalism is advocacy. It's very hard to pull those two things apart. And they said, well, look at the monkey. He's being tortured. And I immediately was like, oh, this is what I'm dealing with now. So I had a lot of back and forth with them. I ultimately was able to do a video about it where I had to give a little bit and basically read the Chinese penal code, like, or the Chinese, not the penal code, but the code of ethics for animal research on air. It felt like I was reading a pill bottle, which was ridiculous. But I realized in writing that piece, one of the themes that I explored in it, which has been explored time and time again, is that we all have sort of an arbitrary line in the sand about what is ethical and what is not ethical when it comes to animal research. I personally, and it's grown with me, don't think that we should be performing research on great apes or elephants or probably dolphins. These three creatures, in my mind, are somehow be above an arbitrary line that I've drawn.
Right.
Animal rights activists might say, no, but mice, but hey, that's a slippery slope. What about mice? But even they, I'm like, really? What about Drosophila? A fruit fly? You wouldn't do fruit fly research? And many animal rights activists, okay, yeah, fruit flies. Well, where's that line coming from?
Yeah, because fruit flies are wonderful animals. What are you doing torturing fruit flies?
Exactly. And so it makes me wonder, like, when you, because you have so much experience doing animal research and across the board, where do you have a line in the sand and how did you come up with it?
I'm not going to torture an animal, right?
Sure.
So,
of course.
You know, there's always going to be.
It's always going to be ethical treatment.
Yes. But no, I, you know, well, first of all, I would definitely draw the line at endangered species. So,
sure. Yeah,
no chimpanzees, no gorillas, no dolphins either. I would agree with that. But otherwise, it would depend on the purpose.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's completely fair, too. Yeah. I mean, it's contextual and it's nuanced.
Right. So, you know, if they tell me, well, we want to just, we want 100 monkeys to do surgical practice for our new interns, I would say, no, that's inappropriate. Yeah, that's terrible. If they said the same thing with 100 cats,
Mm-hmm.
I know all the cat lovers are going to hate me for this, but I'd say, okay, I guess that's reasonable.
Or if they say we need 10 monkeys because we're trying to come up with an Ebola vaccine and this is the easiest reservoir animal for us to work on.
Right.
I don't know how many people would say, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Thousands of people are dying.
Show me the justification. Say why you're working with this level of complexity in the animal. And then we can negotiate from there and see if it's reasonable, which is what every IACUC committee is doing,
yes.
Right?
But it's something that I think the public, for whatever reason, it's one of those taboo lines that you don't often see people writing about. You don't see a lot of people crossing. Yeah. And it's not for whatever reason. We know for what reason, because if you're in a position of authority and you're actually doing this kind of research, you have legitimate fears for your lab,
right.
For the safety of your lab. But I would love to see more activists on the other side, activists who are helping to kind of educate the public about why animal research is necessary and dispel a lot of myths. I definitely have talked to people before and they're like, well, I mean, I get it with animal research, but like, you know, I don't think cosmetic research is fair. And I'm like, that's not scientific. That's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Of course we shouldn't be doing cosmetic research.
Right.
That's a completely different conversation.
Yes.
But.
And at the same time, if you're going to complain about research, have you been down to your local Humane Society shelter?
Exactly. And also, do you take Tylenol? Do you get surgery? Have you had the things that we would never have without having animal mm-hmm. research? Because it's a bit hypocritical. I totally get it. I have friends who like don't buy consumer plastics, and I have friends who only eat vegan because, okay, that's great. You know, you can be an activist with your dollar and through your actions. I think that's important. I drive an electric car for the same reason. I'm trying to do what I can do, but you can't do it in name only. You have to actually follow through.
Right. And I think it's perfectly okay for somebody to say, I could never do research on a mammal.
Completely.
Or I could never do a dissection, or I could never kill any animal. I could not eat an animal. That's fine. I would say I will respect your opinion. But at the same time, I'll say, you know, but in order to live in modern America, I'm sorry, you're getting the benefits. Somebody's got to do the dirty job.
Completely. It's like not knowing where your food comes from.
Right.
You know, if you want to wear blinders, that's fine. But then don't try and be an activist about factory farming.
Oh,
if you eat factory farmed meat all the time, it's like you gotta pick one or the other.
Yes. If you're going to come and complain about my lab and my dead zebrafish, I think you should go visit a poultry farm right now.
Definitely. Oh, man. Definitely. And that's a huge problem that we are all dealing with, too. You know, I do not like what happens there. I don't. But I'm also a meat eater. And so I really struggle with, I try my best to eat food that I know is probably coming from a source that's a little more responsible. But at the same time, you see free range on a package. And a lot of times that means they let them out for like 30 minutes. You know what I mean? It's not well regulated.
Right.
And we don't have the same ethics laws. The same ethics laws that apply to laboratory animals do not apply to farm animals.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a totally different kind of conversation to have. Cows and pigs and chickens are not subject to the same kind of ethical considerations that mice and monkeys are.
If you're working with birds in the lab, you cannot simply chop off their beaks to be more convenient.
Yes, exactly. No, you cannot. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't realize too how expensive it is, how much red tape it requires. And also when you do start working up to those larger like primates, for example, how attached you do get. I mean, researchers respect their primates. They know their primates. They know their personalities. They're not wasteful with these animals. Not only is it incredibly expensive to keep a primate, it's also invaluable to their work. And that primate has a personality. They're so human-esque. I mean, this is the same reason that the activists are afraid or are upset with the use, those same emotions exist in the researcher.
Right.
You know?
Yes. And it's we make rational decisions. And sometimes they're not the happiest decisions. But
exactly.
They're necessary for the work.
But if we were only to make, you know, emotional decisions, we would be in a, well, I would say we would be in a far worse place. We'd be far worse off in this country. But we can see the effects of emotional decisions in, right. in our legislature all the time. And so that kind of brings me to back to your blog, back to Pharyngula or Pharyngula. I'm excited to see how much of the blog has become kind of a hybrid of science and policy, a hybrid of science and maybe activism is the wrong word, but no, there's some activism there and definitely educational effort, skepticism,
right?
All of those things. And so, you know, you talk about evolution, of course, but you also, I think, talk about things that are beyond the scope, I guess, of evolutionary biology, which is important, you know, questions about whether or not God exists, questions about whether or not these types of governmental policies are healthy or scientifically sound. One thing that I see on your blog, and I say this because I've seen it firsthand, is that you strike me as such a rational, mild-mannered, sweet and pro-feminist man. You know, I even see, like, on your Twitter description, I think it says that you're, like, a full-time feminist or something along those lines. And there's a lot of vitriol in your comment sections. Do you usually do you comment about that?
Yeah, and it's been a long simmering, difficult situation because what's happened is that because of my interest and because my concern about social justice and things like that, the blog has become a haven for a number of people who see it as a safe place for women and transgender individuals and all that to not only be able to be comfortable but to fight back.
Sure.
And so yeah, there's a lot of well-earned anger that gets expressed. And what it means is that if you come in with some casual sexism or some stupid remark that shows you never even thought about feminism, or you come in and defend any of these horrors like Gamergate, there's about a dozen people that will fence you on the spot, right? And as I said, it's a little bit difficult because on the one hand, we want to encourage a diverse group of people to come in and talk and have a conversation. But on the other, you know, some of these people are just assholes and they deserve it.
Totally.
So,
especially, when they come in and they come in with a sexist remark. You know, I remember doing, probably the only reason I know this is because I did an episode of The Point, which was a TYT spinoff way back when, and you graciously contributed to the episode. So it was myself, I hosted, and then I had, I put this together with the producer. I had Sean Carroll, Edward Falzon, and Michael Shermer on as panelists, and I wanted to do an hour about atheism. And I wanted to do it differently than we usually see an hour about atheism done because I didn't want anybody who's not atheist on the panel.
Right.
It was not a conversation about whether or not God exists. It was a conversation about what it means to be an atheist and how we all have varying opinions and how we're moral people and, you know, all those conversations. And so the format of The Point, for anybody listening who doesn't watch it, back in the day was there were three people who did these kind of recorded things where they said, I'm so-and-so and this is my point. You made a point. And so because of that, you cross-posted the episode on your blog. And I remember you said something really funny, which was like, it was a great experience, blah, blah, blah. I've determined that Sean Carroll is right about everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, he is.
I love Sean. He's the best. And so, I generally stay away from comment sections on YouTube as a rule because they're the worst of the worst of the worst.
Oh, yeah.
But I do like to engage in comment sections when I think that they are constructive because it's how I get close to my fans. And so I remember reading the comments of that blog post and it was mostly, you're right, one or two squeaky wheels. One guy comes in and says something about how I was feigning femininity to fit some sort of mold of what society did. It almost didn't make any sense, but I was like, okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, like I had mannerisms. I would tuck my hair behind my ears. I would speak like a girl, yeah, whatever. And then there was an army of people who came to my defense. And it was interesting to see how divisive it became very quickly. And this is a struggle that I deal with doing on-air work versus podcasting. when my face is on the camera, almost instantaneously, the conversation can shift away from the content and into what I look like, what I'm wearing, how I carry myself, my physical mm-hmm. mannerisms, which is why I love podcasting so much. I get to sit here with you. I get to talk to you. I don't have to wear makeup. We can be tired at the end of a long conference day. You shouldn't be tired because you still have to give your talk.
I better, yeah.
But we get to not worry about that one component.
Right.
Which can be really frustrating as somebody who is trying to communicate content.
Yes.
You know?
You know, then that's another privilege we guys have. When I'm on, nobody talks about how lovely I look. So I don't have to worry about that aspect of it.
It's true. It's kind of built into society that men, there's an expectation that, for example, men, like a fine wine, get better with age. Definitely the grayer your beard becomes, the more I trust you and the more kind of responsible you are. Whereas
really?
The okay. grayer the woman's hair becomes, the more kind of hysterical she may be or the less likely she may be to be able to hold office, for example. Or, oh, she's yes. aging out of that. She's probably getting weak in the noodle. Whereas a guy can age much more gracefully in front of a camera, which is frustrating. We see it with Hillary Clinton. I mean, look mm-hmm. at the backlash around Hillary's new campaign. And lover or hater, let's not make it about the fact that she's kind of old.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, because she can be running against a much older Republican and it will never be an issue.
It would never be an issue, right. Exactly. And also there's the secondary thing of what are you wearing? How do you do your makeup? How do you do your hair? Do you cry, right?
Oh,
yeah. When a man cries, it's so endearing. When a woman cries, she's insane. She's so hysterical. She could never make responsible decisions about leading the country.
Uh-huh.
Gosh, what a double standard.
Yeah. But, you know, this also feeds into the issue with my blog comments is that I am extremely conscious of the fact that I'm a white, older male.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've attracted a large number of active feminists, young women, minorities, gays and lesbians, I feel like this is their place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not for me to come in and say, well, as the authority here, you now have to stop talking about this and talk about this other thing.
Because it really can spark a whole other conversation that sometimes might be more necessary than the original blog post.
Right. Yes. And I also feel like I'm learning from the comments that, I throw up the initial post to spark the conversation, but then what follows is what's personally very interesting to me, and I try to avoid leaping in. And you know, it's like you feel like you're tainting the communication if you interfere. So I tend to be more standoff from it. I will step in when there's some egregious problem. You know,
sure. Like that's when the block button becomes important.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But otherwise, I kind of like having it freewheeling, and I'm happy to learn from these people who are not like me, and I actually get kind of resentful when people who are like me come in and insist that their privilege means they've got authority in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think that your blog is uniquely positioned because I think the readership is likely predominantly very educated people. So even when you have these intense back and forths that might be racially or sexually or whatever charged, they're between thinking people who, you know, it's not like a YouTube comment where somebody's just trolling, where somebody's pretty ignorant about a topic and they're just trying to get a rise out of you. It's bright people who have deep-seated thoughts, feelings, beliefs, or notions, and they're having intellectual exchanges about that.
Right. Although I'd be careful about saying that they're more educated, because I don't think that's necessarily true.
Really?
There's a number of people. Yeah, there's clearly people who've got PhDs mm-hmm. and so forth talking in there. But they're not supposed to make the argument from authority, right? They're not supposed to do that.
Sure.
And it should be a comfortable place for somebody with a high school education to come in. But I will agree that one thing you have to have is a respect for knowledge and wanting to learn more.
And sure. And maybe educated isn't even the right term. You're right, because even a high school education I think of as being educated in this culture. I guess it's more about a level of like maturity and respect. Like when I think of YouTube comments, I think of 11 and 13 year old boys. Right. Who are doing and saying things because it's hilarious to them to try, you know, but they haven't developed that part of their, you know, that frontal lobe yet to have that executor to know like, oh, this could be deeply like harming somebody's self-image to say these things to them or whatever. Right. It's just not there yet.
And then there's a trauma of discovering they're not 11-year-old boys, they're 30-year-old men.
Oh, seriously. That's even, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt by saying they're 11-year-old boys. So depressing. So, you know, I really, I've got to say, I really appreciate, first of all, you coming here and you having this talk with me. It's been very enlightening. I've learned a lot about you that I don't think I knew, because in some respects, I kind of considered you a bit of an elusive character. I'm not sure why.
Oh, really?
I know. I'm not sure why. I always kind of had that in my mind of this kind of, you had this blog and you were a voice, but I guess you were still a bit intangible to me as a human being because we've interacted before. Yeah. We, once, I think, which was many years ago. And for anybody listening, I try not to talk about this too much because my personal life, I talk about my personal struggles with depression. I talk about coming out as an atheist and stuff. But my personal, like, romantic life, I kind of feel like is nobody's business. But the past is the past. I never talk about the present. And if you do a quick Google search, you know that I dated for some time Bill Maher. And I met you at an event held by Richard Dawkins, right? And he was giving Bill an Atheist of the Year award.
For Religulous, yes.
For Religulous, yes. And there was a lot of backlash, I remember, when Bill got that award, because a lot of people, for good reason, were concerned about his scientific rigor. You know, he definitely has said things and done things on air that I disagree with. I definitely disagree with certain aspects of his views about medicine and about vaccination. I think that his views are in many ways the views of somebody who doesn't have a scientific background. Right. They're the views of somebody who has a very strong deference for science, but also a very strong deference for liberalism. And sometimes those things get conflated. One thing that I deal with in the as being in the public eye and being a staunch liberal, yes, I'm a progressive. I wouldn't even call myself a Democrat. I'm way left of the Democratic Party, but my decisions are informed by the science. So I'm pro-GM. I'm pro-vaccine. Right. There are a lot of things that liberals get really pissed off at me about. Bill, of course, not that he follows party line, but I think that there are things about GM technology that he doesn't understand. There are things about vaccine technology he doesn't understand. And he's a Hollywood liberal, which means that he lives his life in a very he's surrounded by people who promote the kinds of like woo medicine and health trends.
The Hollywood bubble. Yeah.
Hollywood bubble. Exactly. Okay. It's a good way to put it. And so at the time, I remember there was a lot of backlash, but you were sitting at the table that we came into. We swooped in probably late because he had just come off of filming Real Time. And I remember that you and I had a brief, but I thought kind of nice conversation in the hallways where I tried to say, like, I'm a scientist. I was very young at the time. You know, I'm a scientist, too. I'm so excited to be here. What a cool honor. And I remember Bill got the, it was, I got to meet Richard Dawkins, and I got to meet him a few times after that, which was really exciting because of his relationship with Bill. And Bill got this really cool trophy that I feel like he did not appreciate of a...
They give really nice
gorgeous
prizes.
Trilobite.
Yes.
A beautiful, huge, gorgeous trilobite. And he was, like, kind of messing with it. And I was like, that's real. Like, don't do that. But yeah, you and I met then. Maybe that was 4 years ago, something like that.
I don't remember exactly.
Maybe
but no, I remember.
Four or five. I'm glad you remember. That means a lot to me.
Well, yeah, you know what it, but you know, kind of what I remember is that Bill Maher was kind of a jerk. You know, he blew in and all he said to us was to complain about the brand of bottled water they were
interesting.
Serving. But you were good.
Hollywood
you,
bubble there. Yeah, you, I definitely was not in that bubble. I think at that point, Bill and I, so I was very young. I was 24 when we started dating. And I came to know Hollywood in a really weird way. I was thrown into it. And there are still aspects, I live in Hollywood now, but there's still aspects of Hollywood culture that blow my mind where I just don't understand it at all. In dating him, I learned how to wear a gown. I learned how to wear high heels. I didn't have any of the... I was a struggling graduate student living in New York City, you know, cross-eyed on a microscope all day. But I do remember that that was an interesting meeting, kind of meeting of the minds. It was an interesting thing where these two worlds collided in a way. And I think that that's a cool thing that atheism offers.
Yes.
Is for many people, it's a bridge to science.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, we try to promote it as that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a shift in recent years in that we're also trying to say, you know, at least some of us, that atheism has implications for how we treat our fellow human beings.
Yes.
And that's something that's also important. And there's been a bit of a internal backlash because, yeah, we are saying there's more to life than just science, but you're never going to get me saying that science is not important.
Exactly. Yeah. I should hope not.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, as I said with my comment section, I like having a diverse atheist movement where we've got a lot of different issues coming up and a lot of different people providing different perspectives. And I want to see more of that.
And it's so cool to come to these kinds of conferences, which I can sometimes be a cynic. Again, like I try to keep it away, but I do sometimes feel the Hollywood bubble creeping in, and it's layovers and it's all day to get there and the food's kind of crap and it's not as comfortable as being at home. But then you wake up and you go down and you go, like, these are people I never get to hang out with otherwise. They're people I would never meet. They're people who live in what a lot of like liberal elitists would call flyover states, anything between New York and LA. There are liberals all over the country and there are atheists all over the country, and they're cool people.
Uh-huh.
They're really cool people, and to be able to meet in all walks of life too. I would love to see more diversity. I think that's something we're all pushing toward. I think that culturally it's difficult for, it's much harder for, let's say, I'm Puerto Rican, right? Some of my Puerto Rican friends or some of my Mexican friends, it's much harder for them to come out as atheists because they were raised in like an oppressive Catholic society. It's culturally bound much more than it's just religiously bound. But the more that we see people shaking that off, we've got like amazing ex-Muslim atheists. We've got people from different walks of life. And I think it's getting better.
Yes.
Every day.
And this conference is particularly good for that. I don't know if, did you hang out for any of the parties last night?
I'm going to the party tonight. I didn't party last night. I turned in early, but tonight I'm going to
I turned in early last night too.
Headed to the prom tonight.
Yes. Skepticon is really social. And so I kind of feel like maybe we're doing too many talks this year, but it's the after session that sometimes goes on all night, and you get together with all these people. It seems like every year I come here and there's going to be some long-haired scraggly guy who will come up to me and share his moonshine with me. And I think that's pretty cool.
It is so cool. And it's so cool to hear their stories and to hear how similar and, you know, how far-reaching, but also in many respects, how similar our struggles have been.
Mm-hmm.
Because almost everybody who's an atheist now, not everybody, but almost everybody who's an atheist now had to get out.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who are raised secular. Must be nice. And most of us didn't have that luxury.
Right.
And so it's really interesting to hear their stories about leaving. You know, so many people came up to me after my talk yesterday and said, you know, I was raised Mormon too, and when I left the church, I dealt with this, or I'm still married to a Mormon and I'm struggling with this. And it's just, it means a lot to be able to have that shared experience, which is something that a lot of people don't find.
Right.
You know, there's not a big ex-Mormon community in Los Angeles. Maybe there is, but I don't know of them, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so it's great to run into people who have had similar experiences. I think it reinforces to you that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, if I could have spent a career where I just go to scientific conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And there you just talk to these older people and they all have exactly the same interests as far as the big picture goes. You know, of course, the details of science are different. That's depth and interesting stuff to talk about, but you don't get the breadth. And
you really don't. And a lot of people here, they're not even atheists, for example. They're you know, people who have interests in religions that are more, let's say, Eastern religious, or they're whatever label they use. I'm an agnostic, I'm an atheist, I'm a freethinker, I'm a secular humanist. They're all different, and they all have their own ways that they came to this.
And there's no one way to be an atheist anyway.
Exactly. And you can learn so much, I think, from your peers in that respect. So PZ, I want to thank you. Before we go, I want to do what I traditionally do on the podcast with all of my guests, which is close it with two questions that I'm going to pose to you.
Okay.
The first one being, when you look to the future in whatever context matters to you or that you'd like to talk about, when you look to the future, what is the thing that you're most concerned about? What keeps you up at night? But on the flip side of that, the second question would be, when you look to the future, what are you most excited about and most hopeful for?
Oh,
I know. It's yeah. Tough.
Deep questions. Okay. You know, there's not any one thing that, you know, I actually do a little meditation practice.
Okay.
And it's actually relevant to that because, what I'll do is just find a nice quiet place and sit down and think about the future. And what I think about the future is I'm an old guy and I'm going to die, right? And so there's that dismal prospect that, yeah, I know I've got what, 10, 20 years left in me. That's kind of, I hope. Better be at least that much. I got things to do. But you know, I have this sense of my mortality coming up on me.
Sure.
But you know, what I think about is that after I'm gone, my kids will go on.
Mm-hmm.
And after they're gone, I'll be forgotten. But people will go on. That what I like is the thought that people will still be dancing 100 years from now.
That's wonderful.
Well, I don't know. Thinking about death isn't so wonderful. But, you know, that what I find is a great deal of comfort in the continuity of life on the planet. And
yes.
That's kind of what I expect. And I know for a fact that I cannot predict what will happen, that there will be terrible things that will happen and there will be good things that happen. And the pleasure is just in contemplating the fact that things will go on somehow.
And don't you think that if we never had to stop and think about our own mortality, if we never had to think about how easily, as they say, it can be taken away, or the fact that at the end of a long, fulfilling life, the lights go out,
mm-hmm.
we might not appreciate the things that we have quite as much.
Right.
There is something about that understanding of death that really makes everything else
mm-hmm.
meaningful.
Yeah, and I think also part of it is that if you have empathy and you can recognize the reality of other people's lives, you can appreciate the fact that they don't need you, right? That they can still be doing good things without you. So it's not... my feeling about my future, hopefully distant future death, is that it won't make a big difference in the world, and that's wonderful.
And I bet you Hitch would be with you on that. I think he probably would. That sounds
he probably would, yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like something that he would agree with. Well, PZ, thank you so much for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to your talk.
Okay, put the pressure on. Yeah, but no, it'll be great. It'll be fun. Yeah.
And for everybody else who's listening, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.